Good morning, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The Supreme Court will today hear oral arguments in the case against Arizona's strict immigration law. The law's official title is Support Our Law Enforcement and Safe Neighborhoods Act. It's known more widely as SB 1070, and it was passed 2 years ago. In Wisconsin, Hartford Republican Don Pridemore introduced a narrower version of SB 1070 in the state legislature last year. But the Republicans didn't act on it before the end of the session last month. In many other states, there have been laws passed that are similar to SB 1070. And here to talk about this very important Supreme Court oral argument and decision, ultimately, probably sometime in the next couple months, Kathy Lohr, national correspondent for National Public Radio. Hello, Kathy. Thank you so much for being with us. You're in Atlanta, right?
I am. My pleasure to be here.
Yeah, great to have you here. Also with us to talk about the legal issues being argued today at the Supreme Court, Carissa Hessick, who's a law professor at Arizona State University. Hello, Professor. How are you?
Hello. Good, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thanks very much for being with us. Let's start with you, Carissa. There are parts of this bill that are extremely controversial. Can you talk about what is so controversial about it, the aspects of the law that are controversial?
Sure. So the judge in this case has blocked four different sections of the bill from going into effect. The section that probably has gotten the most attention is a section that requires Arizona law enforcement officers to ask for proof of immigration status if they have reasonable suspicion that someone is in the country illegally. That's the provision that's really the most controversial. It's the most controversial because people believe that it will, or people have argued that it will lead to racial profiling. That's actually not really the grounds that the United States has challenged it on, but that's the most controversial provision really at issue here.
Mm-hmm. And Carissa, the Justice Department is opposing this based on it's a federal area. It's not a state area. Federal government should have control over immigration policy. Is that basically their case?
That's right. There's a clause in the United States Constitution called the Supremacy Clause that says, you know, the United States sort of wins if there's a disagreement between it and the states. And so this issue, it's a legal issue called preemption. So the United States is arguing that Arizona's SB 1070 is preempted by federal law.
Has there ever historically been anything like this?
There were a number of instances of states trying to do their own thing in immigration in the 1800s and the early 1900s, but it's been quite a while since we've seen states take the active role that they've been taking. And as you noted, it's not just Arizona. There are a number of states across the country that are looking to take a more active role in immigration.
And depending how the Supreme Court rules, there could be a number more states passing their own laws.
Exactly.
Let's just look generally at the whole issue of immigration reform. I was listening to Senator Dick Durbin last night, who was saying there's probably very little debate that we do need immigration reform in this country. We're just having a hard time getting there. Would you agree that most people would agree with that, Professor Hessick?
I think that's right. I mean, I think that a number of people think that or list immigration as an important issue. They don't think that we necessarily have the correct policy. Unfortunately, it's such a controversial issue that I do think it's difficult for lawmakers to come to compromise an agreement that's going to get buy-in from a number of different sectors.
Mm-hmm. The same people who did the Affordable Health Care Act are also arguing this before the Supreme Court. Why?
Well, there's a really small Supreme Court bar, so a small number of attorneys who have a practice of appearing before the United States Supreme Court and who are really, really good at it. Paul Clement, who will be arguing this for Arizona, is actually the former Solicitor General of the United States. He's a fantastic Supreme Court advocate. So, if people have a case that's made it all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, they usually go out and get the best lawyer that they can.
Mm-hmm. And for the government?
And for the government, it'll be the Solicitor General's office. And the Solicitor General handles all cases that the United States brings before the United States Supreme Court. It's a small division of the Department of Justice with a number of really talented lawyers who are also fantastic oral advocates.
Mm-hmm. He didn't, however, perform very well for the Affordable Health Care Act argument.
That's what a number of people have said. I think arguing before the Supreme Court is outrageously difficult, so I would I wouldn't want to say that someone didn't do a good job.
I would imagine it's difficult. You got to just keep your nerves totally under control, right?
And they can ask you all sorts of questions that you aren't anticipating, and the justices are extremely, extremely intelligent people who've had a very long time to think about all of these issues. So the thought that they would ask someone a question that someone wouldn't be able to answer well, I don't think is surprising.
Kathy, give us a feel, because I know you've been covering this, for what other states have done. Everything's on hold at this moment. Have they passed more restrictive laws than Arizona? Have there been consequences already, even though those laws are suspended?
Actually, there are consequences, and the laws do follow Arizona's law. So there, some are considered perhaps more restrictive, but most of the provisions of those laws haven't gone into effect yet. And so far, there have been laws passed in Alabama, Georgia, South Carolina, Indiana, and Utah that are patterned after the Arizona law. And as we said earlier, among the most problematic parts is that this idea that law enforcement officers would be required to determine the immigration status of a person if they stop somebody for another violation, whether that's a traffic ticket or anything else, and if they think there's a reasonable suspicion that that person is here illegally. And so that we talked about raising questions about racial profiling. I was in South Carolina a few months ago, and even though the law wasn't in effect, there were immigrant groups telling me that traffic stops had been set up and that they were, perhaps liquor enforcement type things. But basically, in those stops, people were being pulled over and asked for their papers. And if they couldn't produce them, they would then be taken away and detained and then perhaps go into deportation proceedings. So, people there were saying they're afraid to go out. They're afraid to go to the store. They're afraid to go to church. It has caused a lot of fear in some communities.
There was it in the state of Alabama where they were checking the status of students' parents?
Well, students and parents. I mean, that is part of the law. It requires public schools to determine whether or not kids were born here in the U.S. and whether their parents might be illegal immigrants, and then report all of that information to the State Board of Education. Even though this isn't happening, people were very upset about this, and ultimately this was enjoined back last October. But parents said they were afraid to send their kids to school. They pulled them out of school. Some schools were half empty. And my understanding is that some families left the state, but, perhaps temporarily, until this could be worked out to see whether or not, this would actually be moving forward. Another provision that's, been particularly troubling to some is this provision against harboring an illegal immigrant. So it would be unlawful to transport an illegal alien or shield them or harbor them or have a business agreement with them. So that could mean renting housing to somebody or granting a business license or so many things. So this is such a big area, and ministers and many nonprofit groups, some people that run shelters, said they would be committing a crime if they helped an immigrant.
What about in the state of Arizona, Carissa? What have been the consequences of this bill? Has there been widespread fear? Have people left Arizona?
Whether people have left Arizona, that's been reported. I don't know sort of how well documented that's been. But that was actually the idea that people would leave the state was actually the stated purpose behind the law. The people who passed this law in our state legislature said that they were passing this bill because they wanted to adopt a policy of what they call attrition by enforcement, meaning that if they were going to enforce immigration laws more strictly than other states in the United States, then Arizona would be unattractive for illegal aliens. And let me add that although I think that the idea wasn't just to push people to other states, the idea was also to discourage people from coming to Arizona in the first place, Arizona being a very popular place for people to cross the border from Mexico.
Mm-hmm. Where did we ever get the phrase illegal aliens? It sounds like people are from outer space.
I'm not sure. It's actually, I know that it's a term that's really contested right now whether to use it. It's actually a term, though, that actually even shows up in federal laws. So,
right.
It's as far as I'm concerned, it's actually a legal term, even though I agree it has some really awful connotations.
Yeah, I assume it is a legal term. Do you know the answer to that, Kathy?
I don't know the answer either, although, you know, it's preferable to say undocumented workers at this point. And it is a legal term. The other thing I wanted to point out is this issue of self-deportation that Clarissa's pointed out, it comes up down here and in these other states, too. It's kind of like these people will leave themselves and just get out even if they go to a neighboring state. And many of these laws do say, this is the stated intent, is to basically, we want the jobs for our legal workers and not for anybody here illegally.
Mm-hmm. There's been an interesting response from the business community, from farmers in southern states, people in business who are generally not in favor of these laws, which I find interesting. Is that a correct statement?
It is in Georgia and in Alabama for sure. The farmers that grow specialty crops and like peaches, blueberries, Vidalia onions, tomatoes, and these are crops that cannot be harvested with these heavy farm equipment. So there's a lot more reliance on hand picked fruit or vegetables, and it's been tougher in the past year to find people to work in the fields, in part because people are just, when these laws passed, they were just nervous to even apply or go back to perhaps the same farms they'd been working at for years. But the farm community told, and they're a very big lobby in the South, that basically it's costing them millions, perhaps more, because they had, we saw shots of the tomatoes rotting in the fields in Alabama. In Georgia, I was there to see the Vidalia onion crop being harvested, and they were having difficulty getting the onions out of the fields. And it's a very short time frame in which to accomplish that. So, you know, farmers are saying this is costing them a lot more, and they're not very happy in some respects about this. But those who support the laws, again, they say that this is an illegal activity. It should be regulated, that these folks who are taking the jobs shouldn't be taking jobs away from people who are legally in this country.
Right.
So it's a sticky issue in the South.
And I'll just add that I think this extends beyond farmers. I know the Chamber of Commerce here in Arizona has opposed a number of immigration measures that our state has taken, that this may be a broader issue where business thinks that the issue is more complicated, and that if we're going to be stepping up enforcement, we also need to be changing the way we approach, for example, licensing people to work here in the United States, because they do have labor shortages.
I know there have been raids of businesses in places like Iowa. Has that been true in other states?
It's certainly true in Arizona. Our sheriff in Maricopa County, Sheriff Joe Arpaio, conducts a number of raids.
What about in the South, Kathy?
There have been a few raids in Georgia. I'm not sure of the latest. It seems like that perhaps may have died down at this moment.
Mm-hmm. And before we start taking phone calls, I'd like for both of you to talk about why this is an issue that politicians just don't seem to want to touch. Are they worried about losing Hispanic vote? Are they worried about losing conservative vote? When there are people who are dying trying to cross a border illegally, when there are people who aren't sending their kids to school, when there are people who are feeling these people are getting something that's not right, it's against the laws of the country, why is it so difficult for members of Congress to take on this issue in a very deep way? Carissa?
Well, you know, I'm not sure, because you said why are politicians unwilling to touch it? I think you're right to note that it's on the congressional level, right? It's on the federal level,
right,
that it's become
on the federal
a political
level.
Hot potato,
right,
because it's actually quite popular in the states, at least some states like Arizona, to tackle these issues, because I think that there's more homogeneity of opinion in some states. I think it might go back to what we were just talking about with the business interests, which is to say, this is an issue where no matter what sort of stance people take, there are going to be groups that will be unhappy. And it could be because of the way things break down politically, you know, that business interests may also traditionally support candidates where, you know, some of their constituents would want them to take a harder line on immigration. So I think it's possible that parties that would otherwise be feeling a lot of political pressure to be stricter about immigration enforcement also tend to have a lot of groups that would otherwise support them that don't want stricter enforcement policies. So I think it could just be an issue where they don't want to make someone angry.
Mm-hmm. Kathy, what do you think?
I also think there's a lot of debate about the DREAM Act, and it has not gone anywhere for so many years, this law that would allow students to go to school. And, I mean, if that can't get passed, I think the feeling is, how are they going to resolve even bigger questions? So I don't know. I know that the states are tackling it. Now, I have to say that I think there was much more activity in the states. Almost every state considered some kind of immigration bill last year. This year, many were either refining the bills that they did create. Like in Alabama, there's been a lot of legislations to tweak that bill, also some in Georgia. But other states largely have been sort of waiting to see what happens in the Supreme Court. And so I don't know. I think there's a definite frustration that we see here that the federal government is just not doing its job, and though the states are going to step in.
We're going to take phone calls in a moment. Just another question for you, Carissa. As we speak, they are giving oral arguments. Justice Kagan has recused herself because she worked on the case when she was Solicitor General, so we could have a 4-4 decision here. Do you have any indication of where this thing is going, and if, once again, we keep hearing, well, it's going to be up to Justice Anthony Kennedy once again. Is there truth in that?
That's very possible. You know, I think that it's been so long since the court has really tackled an immigration preemption issue that's close enough to SB 1070 that I'm actually not very comfortable making a prediction about what will happen. I will say, though, if this does end up with a 4-4 split, which is possible now that Justice Kagan has recused herself, all of the states that were looking to the Supreme Court for guidance about what to do with their laws are going to be disappointed because a 4-4 split doesn't create any law going forward.
Kathy, what do you think?
It goes back to all these appeals courts.
That are
looking at the issue now, and even the appeals court in Atlanta back in March kind of said, I'm going to defer to the Supreme Court and what happens this summer, and then we'll see.
Well, we're going to welcome phone calls. This hour of the program, we're talking about the oral arguments being heard today, probably as we speak, before the Supreme Court for SB 1070. It's the controversial immigration law passed in Arizona in 2010. We are looking at the legal decision facing the justices and the immigration laws that have been passed around the country. They're on hold right now as the Supreme Court decides this case. It will have fairly profound ramifications. We have two guests with us. Kathy Lohr, national correspondent for National Public Radio. She is in Atlanta right now, and she's been covering these issues all over the country. Professor Carissa Hessick is professor of law at Arizona State University. We are welcoming your calls at 800-486-8655. The question of the hour, of course, is whether or not you think states have the right to decide immigration policy. You can email us at talk@wpr.org. And our Facebook has been getting a lot more business lately with people responding to what the question is, which is interesting because it's great to finish the show and go to Facebook and see what you have to say about these issues. And you've been arguing and agreeing with each other, too, which is an extension of the radio. All good. So the Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Brett Jaspers is our producer. He'll be answering phone calls as we talk. I would think we would have a lot of phone calls on this issue, so call in early. Did I give you the number? 800-486-8655. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The second hour of our program today, we're going to talk about being married. Our guests are comedians, and their book is very funny. They're the authors of You Say Tomato, I Say Shut Up, A Love Story. Annabelle Gurwitch and Jeff Kahn will join us, and their show is going to be in Milwaukee. It's performed by professional actors playing at the Marcus Center this weekend. So we will talk about dating and deciding to get married. They also had a child born with very substantial birth defects. So in addition to dealing with a relationship with a great deal of humor and goodwill and quite a few arguments, they had a life crisis that they dealt with, which is also a part of this book. So that's coming up. Hour two of our show. Welcome to your phone calls. Here's our number again. I would imagine you would be calling in great numbers here, but you're slow to the phones today. We're looking at immigration in this country. So there are several questions on the table. What do you think of immigration law in Arizona? Do you think this is a state issue or should it be a federal issue? And why in the world won't people touch this at the federal level? Why is it so darn controversial? Just for the good of human beings and for the good of society, isn't this something that Congress ought to be devoting attention to, and the presidency? Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. And we start our calls with Charlotte in Brookfield. Hi, Charlotte.
Hello.
Yes, Charlotte, go ahead.
Yeah, no, my question was, what does one have to do, say if you're in Mexico, to get legal entry instead of being illegal? What do they have to do to become permitted into the country? Is there a waiting list? Why don't we allow more to come in legally?
Carissa?
So the number of people who can immigrate from various countries is controlled by the federal government. And there's a quota system actually for various countries. And one of the complaints that people have made in the immigration debate is that that number is too low for Mexico. Given how close it is to the United States, given what our numbers are for other countries, that we should adjust that number upward. It's not that people from Mexico can't come to the United States. It's that they can't stay in the United States for any sort of appreciable amount of time. So it's that ability to stay, to get a visa, to get a work visa, to get some sort of permanent status. That's what the federal government controls, and that number is relatively low, a lot of people argue.
Kathy, let's also look at, this was came out yesterday, the Pew Hispanic Center study putting net immigration from Mexico at zero between 2005 and 2010, the job market in the U.S. being weak, a rise in deportations, changing economic conditions in Mexico. What do you think about that? Why is this happening?
Well, I think, as the report said, that there isn't one reason. I don't know how much the laws are playing an impact. I think that a lot of times people say it's economics. If there's not a job here, then people are not going to be coming as readily. I also wanted to point out earlier that in some of these states that are passing these laws, there are relatively low numbers of what's estimated by the Pew Hispanic Center to be their illegal immigrant population. So, for example, in Alabama, 120,000. South Carolina, something like 36,000. I think in Georgia, 425,000. So it's not all, obviously in Arizona, it's a little bit of a different situation. But in the South, at least, it seems like, a lot of times they'll say, within only a couple percent of the folks in the state are even being reported as undocumented.
Mm-hmm. Where else are our immigrants coming from right now? Mexico is number one. Where else are they coming from? China? From Asia?
From a number of places, including, Canada. This is the United States can be a very attractive place for people to come to, India. But like I said, it's the United States government has this sort of quota system that they adjust from time to time about sort of how many people from various countries can come in. I'm actually not familiar with what those current levels are. But as you might imagine, sort of given the geographic proximity, there's a lot of demand from people in Mexico to come to the United
right.
States.
Thanks, Charlotte, for your call. We go to Dave in Appleton next. Hi, Dave.
Hi, good morning. I'm not sure what the issue is in front of the court. Is it that states are creating laws regarding immigration that is then supposed to be federal prerogative, or is it that states are creating laws or policies that that they are interpreting federal law and then acting upon what they say is federal law? What is exactly the issue in front of the court today?
Carissa?
So it's sort of a blend of the two issues that you just mentioned. So states are enacting their own laws to deal with immigration, and the federal government saying that they can't do that. But the states, their argument in response is, we haven't created the content of these laws out of whole cloth. We've looked to the federal law, and we've modeled our laws after the federal laws. And that's why the states are able to argue that, you know, this isn't sort of a classic case of the federal government doing one thing and the states doing another, and the states therefore should be preempted. It's this new sort of interesting issue, which is, what happens if the states have enacted laws that complement or mimic federal law, and the only real difference then is enforcement levels. The reason this matters is because a big way that the United States would ordinarily win a preemption argument is by saying that the state laws conflict. Because the states have written their laws this way, there is no conflict. So instead, the argument has to be, well, what about the enforcement priorities? The United States has been pretty clear that its enforcement priorities, when it comes to people who are in the country illegally, they're not focusing on everyone who's here without permission. They're focusing on people who are here without permission and who, for example, have a criminal record or who are committing crimes. And they're saying that's going to be our enforcement priority. And states like Arizona and others are saying, no, we want every single person who is here illegally to be removed. So they're disagreeing over the enforcement strategy or the enforcement priorities, and that's a relatively new issue for the courts to deal with. Mm.
And Kathy, there had been a lot of talk when the Health Care Act was being heard before the Supreme Court that there was not an emphasis on precedent. Can you imagine that there will be any kind of emphasis on precedent, and would it be immigration precedent, or are there other areas that would be applicable here when it comes to precedents?
That's an issue that I have not studied as much, I will just say. But I think that the issue is that one of the things that the Attorney General said is that he does not want a patchwork of laws that the states create and then try to enforce on their own. So he's saying the federal government should supersede this. They should decide the priority, and whatever the states are doing may interfere with the federal power to do that. And so they want the states to back off.
Mm-hmm. We are welcoming phone calls, 800-486-8655, and Carrie in Augusta is our next caller. Hi, Carrie.
Hi, good morning. I was wondering if your guests might speak to sanctuary cities in the United States and kind of the stand that those cities have taken, for instance, Madison.
You obviously seem to know about this yourself, Carrie. What's the story with Madison?
Well, it's my understanding that if you actually Google sanctuary cities, you will get some cities throughout the U.S. that kind of take a stand and are not as prohibitive with regard to undocumented workers. I used to work in Madison. I was actually very proud of it. I worked in the early care and education field, and we looked at the kids. We looked at wanting to make sure that those kids are safe and served, and that came after the loss of a child's life in a pool with an undocumented worker that was afraid to put their child in care or couldn't find care a number of years ago in Madison. And so they really took a stand that the well-being and safety of the children of undocumented families is the first priority.
So is this done with cooperation of businesses in Madison, the police force in Madison?
Well, I don't know the intricacies of it, but I do know that if you look up sanctuary city, there will be cities that will show up. I just know that my former work life, we always looked at the well-being of the child first. I was in education, and mm-hmm. we looked at the child, because these were kiddos that were born in the U.S., so they're citizens of the U.S., and we took a stand that child's health, safety, and welfare was the first priority.
Carissa, Kathy, are you familiar with sanctuary cities?
A bit. I mean, so sanctuary cities is sort of a broad term that can refer to a number of different policies. But as the caller was explaining, it often means that, for example, if you have a city that has decided that they don't want to prioritize immigration enforcement, that they'd prefer to prioritize welfare, then if they come across a situation where they find someone who's out of status in the United States, they won't report it. They'll say, look, immigration enforcement is not our priority. It's we'd prefer to make sure that everyone feels comfortable, you know, coming to the state for assistance, whether it be for law enforcement, whether it be, you know, for childcare, whether it be for food, what have you. The interesting thing I think about sanctuary cities is it's almost the opposite situation of what's going on with these sort of statewide laws, where you have smaller communities, you know, cities or counties or what have you, saying we want even less enforcement than we have right now from the federal government. And one of, I think, the very interesting aspects of Arizona's SB 1070 that hasn't really made it very much into the news because it's not part of the lawsuit before the U.S. Supreme Court is that there was a section of that law that said that did away with the ability of cities and localities in Arizona to be sanctuary cities. In fact, like not only did it say that they had to enforce immigration law to its fullest, but they provided for citizens to bring lawsuits against the city or the locality for failing to enforce the law to its fullest extent. So that's, you know, instead of a battle between the state government and the federal government, you see sort of a battle between the state government and its smaller local governments.
What about churches? Can you bring a lawsuit against a church that might conceivably be a sanctuary?
Not under the Arizona law as written. It's you bring the lawsuit against the sort of the government entity, be it, you know, a police department or a city or what have you. It's not written to capture sort of private actors like churches.
Okay. Carrie, thank you very much. Yes, Kathy.
I've also heard, not that they're specifically set up as sanctuary of cities or counties, but, you know, especially in South Carolina, where there seemed to be a lot of fear, that there were places where people could go to sort of get help. And oftentimes it was through churches. And basically that there were cases where the children were legal, the parents were not legal, and perhaps the father had been already being detained. So there are more unofficial sort of sanctuaries is more of what I've heard of.
Hmm. I need to ask about racial profiling because we've heard that term associated with Arizona mostly for a long time now. Is this an issue that we'll hear in the arguments before the Supreme Court, or is that outside the purview of whether it's federal law or state law, and we won't hear that phrase?
The racial profiling issue is outside the purview of the arguments that's before the U.S. Supreme Court. It doesn't mean that one of the justices won't ask a question about it. But I think a sort of important thing to remember about the racial profiling issue is the reason that Arizona's SB 1070 may lead to racial profiling isn't just because of the way the law was written, although that has something to do with it. Reasonable suspicion is a very, very low standard of proof. But the law was written that said written in a way that prohibited racial profiling except to the extent permitted by the United States Constitution and the Arizona State Constitution. And both of those documents, as interpreted by the relevant courts, actually allow race to be a factor in law enforcement. So there's a U.S. Supreme Court case from the 1970s that says, you know, someone's appearance, insofar as it suggests that they're of a particular ancestry, is a relevant consideration for law enforcement officers in immigration. And that's something that the Department of Justice, that argument in that case, continues to use in enforcement efforts across the country. So this case is not about racial profiling, because to the extent that it occurs in immigration enforcement, it's not a situation where the states are on one side and the United States is on another. It's an issue. It's just not an issue in this case.
I see. Here's an email. Kathy, let's give this one to you first. Michael writes in order to stop illegal immigration, we need to put regulations and more oversight on employers who hire illegal immigrants instead of taking away everyone's rights to chase immigrants in the shadows of our streets and homes.
Well, and one of the provisions that I didn't mention of many of these laws is a system called E-Verify. And basically, it would require employers to verify a person is a legal is legally in this country before hiring them, and the penalties would go to the employers who hire. And that is being phased in Georgia and some other states. And I've heard, one, that it's an easy process and that it shouldn't be a problem, and I've heard that it's a complicated process if you're a small business and you might not have the staff to do that. So there is an effort to actually go after businesses who hire people who are here illegally.
David in Racine, hi.
Hello.
Hi, David. Go ahead.
My concern was that the people of Arizona supported their legislature in passing these laws. Was it motivated somewhat by the cost of social services for undocumented people, and are they entitled to any number of services regardless of their status?
So that was certainly one of the arguments. The cost of services is certainly one of the arguments. The cost of, you know, emergency room visits, the cost to the public education system, those arguments were all raised, as well as arguments about law enforcement costs and crime rates. There is some dispute over, you know, what exactly those costs are, whether, the immigrant community contributes to crime problems, or whether they actually have a lower crime rate than non-immigrant communities. So the facts behind the arguments are sort of contested, but you're right, those issues are issues that featured prominently in the debate over SB 1070, and that's one of the reasons why Arizona is saying this isn't purely an issue of federal concern where federal law should trump. If you're talking about the costs of law enforcement, or you're talking about the costs of, you know, medical care or schools, those are the sorts of issues that are traditionally considered state interests, and that's where this issue can really start to get interesting.
Hmm. Many of the states have said that they are doing it because budgets are tight and they want services, any kind of services, to go to those who they can prove are here legally. Mm-hmm. So that did play a very big part in getting some of these laws passed, that somehow the states would save costs. Now, it's not clear, again, how much it would cost to enforce the law.
Thank you, Dave, for your call. We'll take more in just a moment. This hour of the program, the Supreme Court is hearing oral arguments in the case against Arizona's immigration law. Support Our Law Enforcement and Safe Neighborhoods Act is the name of the law. It's known as SB 1070. It was passed 2 years ago. There are specific parts of the bill that are very controversial, requiring state police to check the legal status of persons arrested before they may be released, allowing police to stop anyone suspected of being an illegal immigrant. It makes it an Arizona state crime to be in Arizona without immigration papers, bans undocumented immigrants from applying for a job or working in Arizona, and allows police to arrest anyone suspected of a crime that would lead to deportation. So we're looking at the major issues, why immigration is such a thorny issue, why the Congress is just not taking up this issue, and hearing your thoughts as well. Our guests are Kathy Lohr, national correspondent for NPR, Carissa Hessick, professor of law at Arizona State University. Our number, 800-486-8655, or you can use our Facebook page to give us your thoughts, which is the Kathleen Dunn Show, or you can go to I'll give you those. That's enough for the moment. Two more calls in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We'll welcome more phone calls in a moment. I think about this every now and then, Kathy and Carissa, and you are both very informed on this issue, so you probably have a more educated answer to it. But I've always wondered, And this has been true in the past in this country at times, I'm not sure when. What do you think would happen now if we just said, we're going to open the doors, come on in? Kathy?
Well, you know, based on that survey that we've seen, or the study that we saw by the Pew Hispanic Center this week, more people are not coming. So, I mean, I don't know. I mean, the sense is that, you know, you tear down the fence and that everybody would come over. I don't know. I don't know. I'd like to hear what Carissa has to say.
You know, that's such a tough question. It's true that the United States had really open immigration policies at various points in our history. But, you know, as travel became easier and the world became more global, I don't know if that's something that we could easily go back to. But, you know, then again, maybe the answer is if, you know, entry into this country weren't a scarce commodity, maybe it wouldn't be quite as attractive. It's such a difficult counterfactual. I'm just not sure.
An email that's come in: when a justice recuses him or herself, can they still participate in deliberations, or are they out of that as well?
They don't participate at all. They don't go to the argument, and they don't participate in deliberations. If a justice recuses him or herself, it's usually because they either think it's inappropriate, or it would appear inappropriate for them to be seen as deciding the case. So participating in deliberations would I think count as deciding the case.
So what, do they have a little vacation?
I'm sure Justice Kagan has lots of other stuff to do.
Okay, let's go to Tom in Burlington. Hi, Tom.
We have a heroin epidemic here in southeastern Wisconsin. I don't know how much this is related to it, but there seems to be a double whammy here. When we had American jobs went to Mexico, and now workers are coming up here and competing with Americans for jobs here, which forces down the price of labor in our country, which is an economic real fact of life. Mr. Bush said the illegals will do jobs Americans won't do. The real fact is the Americans won't do jobs at that price. So it's an economic force that's working against Americans. Now, this thing about verifying, one way they get around the verifying the status is they sign an independent contractor form. And when you apply as a job as an independent contractor, you don't have to give your citizenship. And that's one thing that might be closed. Now, the thing with the enforcement priority, as I understand it, is that the government's contradiction against this is that it will jam up, it will cause too many people, too much a log jam of really finding out who the people they are who they want to sort out. But it's this argument is sort of like when Mr. Walker says, well, you don't recall me because my recall is causing an uncertainty, an economic uncertainty, and so business is not hiring people. And I don't know if those things kind of, they don't seem to, it's like apples and oranges, or it's kind of an argument that doesn't really hold.
Kathy.
And is your question that more people are not taking jobs because the illegal immigrants will do
yes.
the jobs for less?
Yes.
For less?
That's the way I'm getting it.
So I think that's what some of the arguments are made in Georgia and Alabama, that it's not that people wouldn't do the jobs. It's just that the price has become so low because there are so many people that don't have to go through the correct channels to hire somebody, are paying them less, are perhaps circumventing tax laws, et cetera. So I think he has a point. I think that's one of the factors that's led to the creation of these laws. But it's also at a time when we've had the biggest recession in so many years. So I don't know why, you know, exactly if that's proven true or not.
Can I just make a quick point about the arguments about a logjam when it comes to enforcement? I think it's just important when we talk about immigration enforcement to not forget that, you know, enforcement happens lots of different places. And so people are skeptical about this idea that we can't enforce our immigration laws against everybody. But we see that all the time when we talk about laws, right? If you think about our criminal laws, we don't enforce all of our criminal laws all of the time, right? We don't prosecute every single person who's guilty of jaywalking. We say we have to set our priorities because we have a limited number of law enforcement officers, we have a limited number of prosecutors, we have a limited number of judges, and so we say we're going to prioritize our most serious crimes, and then we will do some enforcement for our mid-level crimes, and then low levels of enforcement for our low-level crimes. And I think that's that argument about enforcement is an argument that the United States government is making in the immigration context, and they're meeting with a lot of skepticism, even though we buy that enforcement argument in another context.
Mm. Thanks, Tom, for the call. Randy is next. Hi, Randy.
Good morning.
Hi.
Worked for an egg production facility in Alden, Iowa, in the mid-'80s, early 90s. And the owner of the company had hired a bunch of illegal aliens. We had 48 employees, and 40 of them were illegal. Somebody had called the police, not myself, and or immigration, and they came and they took 40 of these people away and deported them to someplace in Oklahoma, or you know, transferred them someplace to Oklahoma.
Where did
and
they
the
go?
The owner of the company approached me one day after we had retrained all the local people about bringing back our crew of 40 again and displacing the local people. And I'm wondering what your experts have to say today about the criminality that this man was actually practicing. And I know that you don't know the man, but I'm wondering what your thoughts were on him actually breaking the law and no repercussions. They didn't approach anybody to ask who had hired him or if anybody knew that they were illegal. Our law enforcement didn't.
Randy, before you go, Randy, I'm just curious. Where did they go in Oklahoma?
I'm not sure of the city, but they took them all by bus. And I was actually there that day, and I had asked them, but, you know, it's been so long ago, I don't remember the name of the city. But they transported them all there and detained them, and I really don't know the outcome of any of them. I'm sure that the owner of the company or the vice president of the company knew, you know, because he had approached me about bringing them back again.
Hmm.
So I'm not sure.
All right. Who wants to take that? Carissa, Kathy?
Well, I mean, I don't think it's a good idea for people to break the law.
it's a clear case of circumventing the law,
mm-hmm.
right?
And that's really unfortunate. I don't think that either people on either side of the immigration debate are encouraging lawlessness. I don't think that you know, the people who are opposed to laws like SB 1070 think that the answer to immigration is for employers and others to flout the law. I think that they think, you know, sometimes you're going to have different enforcement priorities and not everyone is going to get caught, but not that it's a good idea for the people who aren't getting caught to be breaking the law.
No, it's not a good idea. Yeah. Thanks, Randy, very much for the call. Let's just take on for a moment here before we go back to calls the politics of this situation. Once again, we have a major issue being decided in a major political year with a presidential campaign going on. How will politics factor in once this decision is made or even before the decision is made? Kathy?
You know, I think that there are a lot of folks that believe that this is a good time to get something passed. There's a big Republican majority in many of these states. They are basically have been lobbying for this. I guess I will have to see what happens, whether these states will come back given the Supreme Court's decision and make changes or what they're going to do. I think there's a clear idea, at least in the states that have passed these laws so far, that they want to have some kind of enforcement. They want to make some kind of impact.
Carissa?
Well, I'll just add that, you know, Supreme Court decisions have played a role in presidential elections before. I mean, Richard Nixon campaigned, you know, against the Warren Court's decisions and, you know, when it came to Miranda and other cases like that with defense rights. So it's quite possible that, you know, the side that loses before the U.S. Supreme Court will say that, you know, they need to make sure to win the presidential election so that they can control the appointment of justices going forward. So it could actually be the side that loses this case that has more political firepower in the presidential election. Whether they'd actually want to lose the case in order to get that political argument, though, I think is a separate question.
And Kathy, final question. How are people who are here legally and those who are here illegally from foreign countries, particularly from Mexico, because that's mostly the people who are affected, how closely are they looking at this Supreme Court decision and how afraid are they of an outcome?
I don't think that a lot of people who are here illegally are looking at the Supreme Court decision as we are, as some people who are watching it in the media. I think that they're waiting to see whether the states are going to repeal these laws. They're not, and I'm not sure that it's clear to them that it's going to come from the Supreme Court. But I also think, as Clarissa said, there are a lot of specific issues. Abortion would be another one where whatever the court decides, you know, the people that are on the losing side are going to come back and say, let's get our side represented on the court.
Mm-hmm. So the arguments are just today, Carissa?
Yes, that's right. This isn't like the healthcare law where they're having multiple arguments on multiple days. This is a much more classic case.
All right. Well, we'll follow the news during the course of the day. And I thank both of you so much. It was a very informative hour. Thank you for your expertise and for your time.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Our guest this hour, Carissa Hessick, who's a professor of law at Arizona State University. Kathy Lohr, national correspondent for NPR, our guest as well, joining us from NPR studios in Atlanta. Thanks, everybody, for all of your calls. We'll be doing more shows on this issue. We've done some already, and we'll do more as the Supreme Court deliberates, and of course, after they make their decision, we'll be doing a program on this. Thanks to Brett Jaspers for producing this show. Brett's new to this program, and we thank him for his work. And thanks to Brett as well for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. News is coming up from National Public Radio. We'll have some fun the next hour and serious conversation as well. A husband and wife comedy duo. They're writers. They've been actors. They are married. The book that they have written, You Say Tomato, I Say Shut Up, is very, very funny. And all of that is coming up. I hope you'll listen.